I'm just going to start. Because at the beginning, I'm just going to do a recap. Because a lot of people come and go, and sort of now I get more of the feel of what happens here at Holden, right? It's yeah. New people show up, some people are on the bus, and they go, oh, wait, there goes the people who are my regulars. Oh, no. And so I thought, you know what I do? And so the theme of what I'm talking about is this idea that one of the things that defines us as human beings is that we interpret ourselves, we interpret the world, we live interpretively, but especially ourselves. And it's part of what makes us what we are, is that we're beings that interpret ourselves by telling stories about ourselves and make sense of our lives by telling stories about ourselves. And what I liked about the topic was that it seems to be fairly so commonsensical, so obvious, like I already spent 5 days talking about something so straightforward interface as that, is that when you start sort of digging in, it starts getting more and more complicated and more issues start falling out in really exciting ways. So I thought maybe what I'd start to do is just mention all the things that have sort of come up relevant to the story over the last 3 days. And the idea of that is that any of these are on the table. If you'd like to talk about any of these, and then I'll move on and add some more to it today when we talk about a German, 20th century German philosopher named Martin Heidegger, and what he has to add to our picture and to our story. So the very, you're all getting ready, for this.
Yeah.
So the some of the very first ideas is that, so we're beings that tell stories about ourselves. We're author. It's like we're authors of our own lives, in which we're the main character, right? But we're not really authors, right? We're actually co-authors. Other people collaborate with us to help us tell the stories of our lives. And our stories are constantly intersecting with other people's stories and affect other people's stories. You think that your narrative, but you know, the sorts of stories that you take up turn out to change other people's stories, other people who are related to you. And you often find yourself in positions where, maybe my example is that my example was I was a student, exchange student in Sweden in college. My grandparents came from Sweden, and I decided, I felt so comfortable there, I thought, I could live here, right? And I realized that if I made that choice, my family story just changed to, you know, Sven and Edith came to America and David returned, right? It's like, I couldn't just go to Sweden. I was returning to Sweden as a member of a family, right? So there's all these things that are beyond my control in the narrative. So partially your co-authors, much is beyond your control. And maybe the most important things of who you are, like when you were born, who you were born to, those early formative years that you have no say in at all, right? That only over the course of your life you can look back on and take up and learn about and try to put yourself in a position to be reflectively responsible for. All right, so we talked in the very first day about learning about your family and learning about your family history. Because often you find, late in life, this is sort of story, maybe some of you know these stories, you find late in life, you meet some long-lost relative and they say, you're just like your aunt that you never knew, right? This person, they say, you're just like her, I have no idea, right? There's sort of this history of being me that I've just discovered. Because I've learned now about my family, what biggest insult is, you're just like your mother. Oh no, I'm turning into my mother, right? That's sort of, a lot of people, it's a horrible thing, right? But you gotta sort of learn how to respond to that. I mean, we'll be surprised if we shape them like that. Okay, so much is beyond your control, and part of interpreting your life is taking up all that, as much as you can that's beyond your control, and bringing it into the storybook and trying to make it your own. Take responsibility for it. One of the main themes is the more you can take responsibility for who you are, in some sense, the freer you are to be yourself, right? The less you find yourself being shaped by things that you don't even know that are going on. So at the heart of this is this idea, I called it autonomy. It's this philosopher's word, which means self-legislating. Right? The idea is that you are the source of the values. Telling these stories also adopting values, because what you're doing is you're explaining why you made the choices you do and why you're going to make the choices in the future. Sunday night's sermon was trying to explain why, and then the one was the boss, why Jesus did this and not something else, and what we look for are reasons. You need to have reasons. When you're telling these stories, you're looking for reasons of why you are the way you are, why you have, and reasons when it comes to life are values. What are the values that are guiding these choices? What are the values that are at the root of who you are? And the way you go. So values are part of these narratives. I mean, I gotta get used to it. I'm not used to these computers yet. They shut off on me. Because it's part of who you are, because it's part of who we are as human beings, doing it well is part of simply being a successful human being. It's like part of your humanity is to perfect telling these stories. So there's a kind of moral responsibility to tell these stories, to be a human being. So there's a moral responsibility. To do it well. And tomorrow, what we're talking about more and more tomorrow is what it means to tell a good story of your life. You know, what exactly I mean? The idea is that there, we have great examples. All week we've got Bible study examples of interpretations. You know, and some interpretations are better than others. There's probably no one interpretation which is definitive. No other interpretation gets anywhere near. But you can give evidence and give reasons and give sort of understanding. Some interpretations are more insightful than others. And that's one of the things you're looking for. What you're looking for, we've already saw some of this. What you're looking for is a narrative that gives you insight. That is, the process of narrating yourself is a process of self-discovery and self-creation. And you should be the same person in some sense afterwards. Right? It changes who you are because now you understand better who you are. Okay, so it should be something that's rich with insight. It shouldn't make sense of your life. It shouldn't make your life intelligible. There shouldn't be major periods of your life that don't fit the story. I mean, that's sort of a suspicious moment that happens.
go back over here.
This is a long list. I hope you're ready here. We got some time. Are we doing okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. Thank you. It has practical consequences. If when you do this, you come to understand yourself better, it doesn't help you live better. It doesn't help you make choices better, see more clearly what you want out of life and what you're seeking out of life and where you're going with life, then this is not a very successful interpretation. Right? Practical consequences should be at the forefront of a successful self-interpretation. There are ways in which you can think about past events. We're in sort of the midst of the biblical hermeneutics night, whatever that is, right? There are ways in which you can think about past events. You should always treat past events in context. So you look back at choices you made and decisions you made. Keep in mind, I was 13 or something like that. What, you know, given what you knew at the time, there's a way in which. So treat past events in context. But realize, too, they may foreshadow future choices. As you think about what's important to you, you may remember something in the past that you haven't thought about, you know, in decades, and you realize now how central that was. You know? It may foreshadow, it may reveal patterns about you. For better or worse, as you come to understand yourself better, you may notice patterns coming up in your relationships and your career and whatever it is, and you sort of realize this is not just something that keeps happening over and over again. This is part of who you are. Successful or unsuccessful patterns. You recognize meanings. And now what I meant by that, when I talk about that, is the idea that sometimes it's not the event that's really important, it's what you took from it, what you learned from, what it taught you about something. And that's where it stands. It stands at the sort of it's the meaning of this. I didn't really rather that it was this person or this thing. It's that I learned at that moment, you know, whatever, right? It's the moral that came out of it. That's important. So these are ways in which you look to your past and think about how your past fits in the present and directs you onto your future. Here's a complicated one. You have to take seriously the idea that you might not be, it's hard to write way up high, something moving, sorry about this, your own best interpreter. And that's an important realization, and maybe it's a truism, maybe no one is their own best interpreter at some level. Maybe some people are better than others. I thought of a book. It's by a guy named, I think his name's David Carr. He's a journal. He's a writer for the New York Times, and he wrote a memoir, which is our word for autobiography these days. He wrote a memoir about a time in his life where he decided he was utterly unreliable as a writer, and so he did it as a journalist. As a journalist, he went back and interviewed all these people connected to his life at the time to find out what he was like at the time and what happened at the time, because he decided that his memories of it, whatever he had, just weren't to be trusted. And other people are in a better position to tell the story than he is. So one of the questions is, are you really in the best position to be the one to sort of narrate yourself?
Does that stand sort of in contrast to being those co-authors, which you describe as being collaborators? Is it possible that those sort of co-authors are actually antagonistic?
There might be. There are co-authors who are just who are actually collaborators, right? People who are working with you to help you better understand yourself, and they could be antagonistic. It could not be. The example I gave, and it's an ancient Greek example, is the example for the ancient Greeks, the friend, the way you could tell a friend is they're the ones that could speak the rude truth to you, is the line. I mean, Plutarch has a saying, the title is How to Tell a Friend from a Flatterer. That was the real distinction. Someone who would just tell you whatever you want to hear versus someone who would really tell you what you need to hear. So that's kind of antagonistic, right? But the reason they're your friend is that you know they have your best interest in mind. They're looking out for the good in you. All right, so they're collaborators, but it's antagonistic, but you realize that they're helping you live better. I mean, that's a kind of co-author that is very useful. There are people who, on the other hand, are well-meaning, but don't have your best interest in mind in your narratives, right? I mean, some of the greatest conflicts, I imagine, that occur in your life are conflicts between people who have a story about you that just doesn't square with how you understand yourself, and it gets these things get locked in, right? And you never break out. There was an example. I don't know if that woman's still here. Some of you I recognize your video, but it was a woman who her brother had this sort of constant sort of tense relationship, and they're sort of locked in with their narratives of each other until they ended up just as a coincidence meeting in what's called a neutral space, some place that was not familiar to either of them. And for the first time there, it wasn't Thanksgiving dinner, it wasn't the holidays, it wasn't this family context where all the dynamics were rich. It's just there they were, these two people, and they discovered each other completely anew in that moment, right? So there is a way in which you can sort of recognize that you may not be the best person to tell the story, and you can find trusted friends to help you do this, right? I guess that's fair. You also need to be concerned about the audience. When you think about these stories, you gotta think about who the story's for. We had examples of, I want my children to know the story of a family. And that's one kind of story you're going to tell. It's a story that you want your children to hear. It may not be the same story that you tell yourself, right? In the sort of moments of brutal honesty. Or in Augustine, moments of confession where the audience he thinks is God. There's more than we're Kierkegaard, right? There's this idea that no matter what you understand about your past, we did a lot in like 3-4 days. Yeah, sort of exploded. I hope you keep track of all this. And we can talk about any of this tonight, but there's still more to go. No matter what happened in your past, everything you understand about yourself up to now is never quite enough to guarantee your next step is the right one. So he's got a line that you understand backwards, but you have to live forwards. And he says there's always a gap there, and that gap will always be a kind of leap of faith. So if you think about this, you're telling the story of who you are, where you came from, and where you're going. The where you came from doesn't quite get you the full story about where you're going. You need, and Kierkegaard is going to say, how about the past? How am I good at this? Past doesn't guarantee the next choice is the right one. There could be lots of right ones. I went out of necessarily right that I thought I didn't like how that was. I should have just put Kierkegaard's. You understand backwards and live forwards, but that's the idea, right? Is that Kierkegaard's going to say, if you have two parts of the story, where have you come from and where are you going? The where are you going is the key part. he's going to say. Because so where you come from only gets you here, and there's still now all these opportunities before you about where you're going. And it may be that at this moment is the moment of rebellion where you decide to turn against, right? The turning point that occurs in your life when you came to Holden and you saw your life as having a certain sort of trajectory and no more, right? And it's going to be tough because you're going to have to turn against your family and your friends and all these people who are sort of collaborators in your life up to now. But you realize that things have changed, right? And you're no longer that same person. And now we need a new story. And in doing and making this choice, you also will undoubtedly recognize the roots of this choice in the past, right? The story will be told, so you'll see, look back and see these moments and say, I should have seen this coming, right? So Kierkegaard's going to say that the choice you make about the future is what really matters in this story of narrating yourself. And he's going to say, and Kierkegaard's also going to say, that making this sort of choice is serious. That is, this is not just some sort of small decision among all the options out there. It's serious, and it's not encouraged, not socially encouraged. It's easy to avoid. You don't have to make it. You can live your whole life without ever making these kinds of choices, without ever making these kinds of decisions, without sort of setting out and saying, yeah, but, you know, where am I going? What is the story of my life? What is, you know, what are the values that are going to take me on from here? And he says, and there's something very comforting in not having to make that choice. Because inertia is powerful. Right? Inertia will carry you all the way through. And you never have to ask it. But it's, yeah.
Does Kierkegaard speak only to individuals' choice, or does he speak to the choices made by countries as well, and cultures?
Oh, he only speaks to individual choices. But I suppose it would work for countries and cultures too, wouldn't it? Yeah, the same sort of thing. But he's focused on individuals because part of what he wants to talk about is becoming, we talked about this a lot last night, an individual. Becoming part of making this decision, making this choice, may I sort of say a few things about the choice? The choice is difficult. It's a leap of faith. That's one of Kierkegaard's phrases. That is, there will always be this uncertainty in it. You don't, when you make this choice, when you decide this is where I'm going, you won't in that moment know what actually that is going to ask of you. That's why one of the analogies is marriage. You know, you don't actually know what this is going to take as you enter into it, right? But you've made the choice. So you don't know what it's going to require of you. You don't know what it's going to ask of you. It's difficult. It can't just be, well, there's lots of choices out there. I'll just choose this, and if that doesn't work out, I'll choose something else, right? It needs to be a choice that helps to define who you are. And as a part of who you are then, you don't just sort of go back and say, ah, that didn't work out. Those 5 years, that track didn't work. I'll go back to where I was before and try a different track. Right? You don't go back the same, right? If it's a real choice. So it's difficult, it involves faith. He says that his word for it involves repetition. The guy we're looking at today, Heidegger calls it resoluteness. The idea is that you have to constantly reaffirm the choice. You know, it's just like, you know, the idea is something to say about marriage. It's not one commitment. The commitment is that you're going to repeat the commitment over and over again. You're never going to stop making the commitment. So repetition is that, yes, you're going to continue to affirm over and over again. That's what the commitment means. Okay, so Kierkegaard says it's becoming an individual that you can only really be sure that your life is yours, that you can say that this really is your life if you go through this process. Because otherwise you never know if in fact what you're doing is just, Kierkegaard's word for it is the public. Phillips, today we're going to talk about, calls it just one. Heidegger calls it just one. It's just what one does. This is just what people do. You know? Unless you sort of really decide, no, this is not just what someone does. This is what I do, because this is who I am. Then you've taken responsibility fully for who you are. And unless you do that, you run the risk of just doing things because it's what one does. Where one is just this anonymous, it's out there, you know, it's the public. It's just this sort of thing in the air. That's the sort of the cultural inertia. I think we're getting near sort of all of these things that are tied up. With this one question. Yeah, okay, so there you go. So that's for those of you who are just joining us tonight, right? Wow, man, and like I said, what I love about this question about what it means to understand yourself, to know thyself, is to interpret yourself, is to tell a story about yourself, right? And all of a sudden, all of these other questions start coming out on the table, and what it means to tell a story about yourself, and what it means to think about the shape of space. Okay, so I'm gonna add a couple of things. So the character tonight, philosopher tonight, I'm going to talk about this guy, Martin Heidegger. He's a German philosopher. This is 1880, I'm going to double check. I'm going to say 6 until I get over there. To 19, no, it doesn't look right. 6 is there. I'm going 1888 to 1976. Yes, you're right. Oh, no! But you know, it looks right. It's 1883. All right, 1883, 1970. He lived a good long time. German philosophy belonged to a tradition called phenomenology. And the idea, at the heart of this idea of phenomenology, is that philosophy can get wildly abstract and lose touch with really what it is like to be alive. And we can only make sense of these really abstract philosophical contexts if we can connect them to our sense of living, of what it is to live as human beings. And if really, if we can just start talking about what it is like to be alive, what it is like to exist as human beings, and start with that, and just start to describe it, and try to get the words that help us see what that's like, then we can work on all these elaborate theories after the fact. But part of the problem, he thinks, is you get going on the theories, and then you just start working out theories, and they're warring theories with all these logical consequences, and no longer connects to, you no longer understand what it has to do with what it means to exist. So, you know, the first thing about Heidegger, I should say, is that this idea that self-interpretation is not just something we do, but something we are, that sort of defines us as human beings, is his idea. That's one of the things he's going to say, is that this really belongs to human nature, is that we interpret things, and we make sense of things by interpreting them, including ourselves, and that partially defines us, rather than just being one of the many things we do. Part of it. So I want to say that part of the idea of this whole idea for this week is this Heidegger idea that this is more than just something we do, it's something we are. It belongs to our nature. Second is Heidegger is very influenced by Kierkegaard. That's the second thing I'd say. So many of the ideas in Kierkegaard show up in Heidegger. There is the idea he calls it. Heidegger was a Catholic theology student, got a degree in Catholic theology and medieval theology, and then read his Luther and had a crisis with Catholicism. And it was like they were reenacting some Reformation. And so you know, broke with the Catholic Church, became sort of a regular philosopher. And he takes these Kierkegaardian themes and gives them sort of Lutheran terms. So one idea that's Kierkegaardian is Heidegger says, calls it fallenness. We're fallen. And what he means by that is that we live most of our lives in a certain sort of self-oblivion. We live most of our lives just habitually. And he says, you know, and we couldn't otherwise imagine the kind of, you lived life in sort of pure, intense self-awareness. That would be crazy. I mean, there are examples of like, there's a famous example of a baseball player. His name is Chuck Knoblauch. He used to be a Minnesota Twin. I'm from Minnesota, so I know this guy. He played really well when he was with Minnesota. Then he went to New York Yankees. He played second base, which is not far from first base, right? You can't get close to first base, second base. And the pressure of playing in New York got to him, and he started to not be able to throw the ball to the first baseman. And it's like this right? And what happened was he just started thinking more and more about it. You know, the ball would come, and he would just start thinking, and he'd just throw it up in the stands. If it happened really fast, it was like what they call a bang-bang play, right? It's just hit fast, he dives, he's fine. But as soon as his brain started getting in the way, it didn't work anymore. And these are the kind of examples that Heidegger scholars love. They say, yeah, you know, most of our life is lived beautifully without our brains getting in the way. And that's actually not such a bad thing. You know, it can be a bad thing if at no point we start asking these questions about ourselves You know, if at no point we, if we just sort of live our whole life in a situation of fallenness, a kind of obliviousness, then in no, in the contrast here, at no point do we really become, in his words, authentic. Which is this idea of being true to yourself. You know, at no point have we really realized our individuality. There's sort of an idea here. I mean, and there's a common idea that the idea is that, you know, I think we all think that we're all unique in some sense, you know. But just because you're unique in some sense doesn't mean that your uniqueness, your individuality, is has been brought to life by you. You know, there's sort of a feeling that unless you really cultivate what makes you an individual, no one else can ever cultivate that. It will die with you, right? I mean, there's a sense in which only you can bring you fully into the world. You know, and if you don't, no one else could. I mean, there's lots of things other people can do for you. You know, people do things for each other all the time. I can help you put bags on and do other sorts of stuff. I can help you understand Heidegger, but I can't help you live the unique person that is you. All right? And no one else can. And it's not going to be taken up after, if you don't do it. All right? And Heidegger has a sense. He says, so this is sort of the idea of authenticity. The problem is we sort of, the fallenness, which is what we need in order to just live our lives, takes over. And we get sort of trapped in the sort of world of the one where we just go through things all the time.
Do you think one of the derivatives of this, not necessarily, I go for it, but is the whole self-help?
You know, there's different versions of self-help.
Right.
I don't know that it's derivative of Heidegger, but I think it belongs to a spirit of the times. Which is this concern for that, a concern that, a concern for helping people become the most, how about this? All self-help is about helping you become the best you can be.
Right.
And then the question is, well, what is that? And I think that nowadays there's an idea that, well, it's to become who you really are, right? To discover yourself, your inner nature or something like this, your individuality. In that sense, it's similar to this, but that I think that's part of the spirit of the times. You won't find that. Someone said last night, you don't have anything about individuality in Chinese cultures. You know? That's right. Yeah, Kierkegaard was a very Danish Christian, you know, it's in from the start. So yeah, I think that there are connections here. There actually was there's a kind of self-help Heidegger book that came out about 2 years ago called Shopcraft. Is that a Shopcraft for the Soul, I think it was. It was a guy who got a philosophy PhD in Heidegger at the University of Chicago, and then decided to work as a motorcycle mechanic. Sounds just like that Zen and motorcycle maintenance kind of book, right? And then the whole book is about the value of work and getting lost in work. And the idea that sort of getting absorbed in these things of your life and becoming good at them, losing track, you know? And in that losing track, you're really good at it. You're really in sync with things. That's sort of this Heideggerian. So this is a Heideggerian self-help book. The idea that you sort of get in sync, and by being in sync, things come easily and naturally and fluidly to you. One of the remnants of Kierkegaard has the idea about despair, and I mentioned yesterday. And for Kierkegaard, it was this constant sort of, he thought we all sort of suffered from a constant kind of deep down feeling, and maybe we try to hide it or deny it or cover it up. That we're not living the life that we should be living. And by that he meant, had this feeling that we're fettering and we're flittering away our time. You know, what we're doing is not the important things. But also the sense of, what are we supposed to do, right? There's also sort of a sense of lostness, but what else can I do? I don't know what more there is to do. And Heidegger has the same idea. He calls it anxiety. And he says it's just sort of this lurking fear you have that this is all kind of trivial. No matter how important you think it is in a moment, every now and then you get a feeling like it's really nothing, you know? And for Heidegger, there are these, and this is what I really want to talk about today. There's a great German word. And the word is, the word is Stimmung. Which translate just means, which gets translated as moods, usually. But it connects to a tuning of an instrument. And so how do you talk about moods, like anxiety, like shame, like feeling at home, or like feeling unsafe, or feeling not at home, feeling ill at ease, about or feeling things like feeling like someone's watching, something like that, right? There's all these moods that he says they're tunings to your environment. So feelings of shame are tunings to is a way in which you're attuned to how other people might be seeing you and thinking about you. This anxiety is a kind of tuning in to the way in which your life might, your environment may not be the providing the meaning it should be. Or, obviously if you're feeling safe, there's a tuning to the environment. And he'll say, was he asked about this? Man who's up there. He'll say that groups could, so he'll say there's a Stimmung, there's a mood, there's a feel to Holden Village. So, right, there's a feel, and maybe once you're here long enough, you get in tune with it. All right, you sort of get in sync with Holden Village. You sort of feel the vibe of Holden Village. You sort of recognize things. It seems very natural for you. You'll never know what's going on up here. That's why you've been here every time. You don't need to know. You're a veteran of this. And what this tuning does is it makes you aware of things. So you notice things. And maybe it's just little things. I've only been here 1 week, and the last time I was here was 30-some years ago. So, but the people who are veterans of Holden Village, been here years longer, are sort of in tune with what it's like to be here, in tune with the vibe of Holden. Maybe people who come regularly are recognize the ways in which it changes. You know, people were in tune to see those. I guess, you know, what struck me was someone mentioned that at communion last Sunday, that people were just sort of coming in and out of passing out communion. You'll be sitting there all of a sudden, you notice, oh, wait, someone else is doing the bread now. All right? And I guess it's just part of the culture here that there's this sort of swap in and out. It's like, here, I'll take it for a while. Yeah, don't worry, I'll do the wine for a little bit. Yeah, go sit down, take a break. And, I didn't notice it, someone pointed it out. Someone who really is sort of in the whole, in tune with Holden, will say, yeah, of course. That's so Holden. You know? They'll recognize that, though. It's a way in which, and Heider says these emotions, these feelings, these senses are a kind of awareness of your world. These feelings are an awareness of what's going on in your environment. And what's important about this is it means that there's this whole emotional level. I mean, as shame is another example, where it's a sense of yourself in a situation. Right? It's a kind of emotional self-awareness in a situation that is not just purely sort of intellectual storytelling. That when you tell these stories about who you are, part of what the stories do is they articulate these emotions. They say why it is you feel shame in these situations. And maybe they say, you know, you shouldn't. Right? I mean, this is one of the things, right? Every one of these examples there's lots of emotions where it doesn't make any sense to say, that's wrong, right? How can emotion be wrong? Each of these makes sense to say, you shouldn't be feeling that. And I feel uncomfortable right now. Don't. It's fine. We're all friends here. I don't feel uncomfortable. But, you know, you see that. You know, I feel like someone's watching me. Oh, there's no one watching you. I know. I feel that way. Yes, I know. But the feeling is about your situation. And you may sort of be missing, you may be out of tune, out of sync. And so all these emotions say something about you and about your setting. And you can see, certainly the shame is a perfect example, where someone sort of feels shame about something, and you can say, you know, you shouldn't be ashamed of that. That's nothing to be ashamed of. You know? They can, and by narrating their life, they learn about these feelings. They learn to articulate what's going on with these feelings and what these feelings mean, because usually they're sort of amorphous, especially with feelings like, Heider's main line for anxiety is you don't feel at home. And it's a very sort of vague thing. He says it's a dissettlement. You can't put your finger on it and say, I'm worried about volcanoes. I heard a story about a little kid that didn't want to come here because he heard there were volcanoes in Washington. And he was anxious about volcanoes. It's not that. You can't say, I know what it is. It's those volcanoes. And you look around and say, okay, I'm good. Right? It has it's amorphous. It has this sense that it's just sort of there. It's just this unsettling. I don't know what it is. I'm just unsettled. Right? I'm not at home here. Literally, the German word is unheimlich. I'm not at home. I don't feel at home. And the point of this is that by telling the story about yourself, by interpreting yourself, you're making these articulate. And by making it articulate, you're transforming it into something that now you can be more aware of, that you can have more response to. You say, now I know what it is. I'm able to speak it. I'm able to say it. I'm able to figure out what the words are. And if I said the project of phenomenology is trying to get at what it's like to live and try to find the words that capture it. And the idea is once you have the words, you're better aware of it. I think one of my favorite examples is if you're drinking wine with someone who drinks wine all the time, right? And you say, well, it tastes like a red wine to me. And they say, do you taste the licorice? You think, licorice? No. Oh, there I do. Now I do. Right? It's like once they sort of give you the word for it, you know what to look for. And now you're attuned to it. And you can taste it. I mean, it obviously was there the whole time, but you didn't pick it out until someone pointed you to it, right? The becoming articulate about it, finding the words for it, tunes you into it, makes you aware of it. And so part of the point of telling a story about your life, too, is it tunes you into yourself. Right? In the same way that you can become tuned into the mood of Holden Village. And then you notice all these things you didn't notice before and think, oh, that's so Holden. I never saw that before, but now I'm really sort of with the place. I know what that's like. In the same way, articulating yourself tunes you into yourself. Yeah.
Do you think there's a dynamic in terms of whether it's written or verbal, uh-huh. whether it's for yourself, whether it's only seen by yourself or if sure. it's shared with others?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't you?
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about it. So did you have something specific in mind?
There's still something in this whole thing that's, and I haven't quite put my finger on it. It seems, and we're getting closer, but it seems so intellectual.
Sure.
And for me, relationships are so important.
Yeah.
And yes, relationships are part of your story, but it just seems, you know, it's all this logic. Why? And if you know why, then you this.
Yeah.
And it's, and you said something earlier about, you know, if it's consistent, which takes away, in my mind, in some ways, transformation or mystery or spirit or, right. you know, it seems so logical and intellectual.
Yeah,
and
well,
that's why I think I bring in the relationship, that's how I bring the relationship thing in, that for me, the sharing of the story,
right.
just sharing it, even if no one says anything, or feedback, there's something between two people and in that sharing.
Yeah.
That's how different than in just writing it down for yourself.
I absolutely believe that. Yeah. I think writing it down to yourself is more than just thinking about it. That if you're just thinking about it, you're like one of my students who says, my paper's done, I just haven't written it yet. It's like, really, no. When you write it, you learn by writing it what you're really thinking. And you don't really know until you try to write it and try to find the words for it. But it's when you talk with somebody else about it, especially somebody else who knows you well. So when I thought about it, yes, it's very logical because I'm a philosopher, and the model I always have in mind is it's done with others. So when I talk about consistency, my what I'm thinking of, and Lori called me on this too, but you know, too consistent to tell one, you tell one story and your whole life gets unified in one story. Mm-hmm. All I meant is that the important moments of your life seem to be part of the story. And it's usually other people who call you on that more than you do yourself. Say, well, this is what I'm really about. And they say, really? You know? Because, you know, there was that. What? And they say, well, okay, that wasn't me. And I'm like, well, that's not an answer, right? Something like that, right? So I guess I'm always thinking about these things that are done in relationship to other people. You're absolutely right. And I think that when you talk about, and this is something I've said a few times, when you talk about it with other people, you learn things about yourself through other people. And the very first day we had the example is Chuck.
George.
Okay, George. I use the example of George wearing this sort of the jacket, right? And how this might be incredibly meaningful to him, but we don't know. We don't know his story. We don't know the history. And maybe this jacket has a family I think the story was that your family ran a wool mills and it shut down, and maybe this was the last jacket they made. I don't know what it was, but it was some sort of honor to his family that he always wore this jacket. And everyone identified, and now he's wearing the jacket every single day, right? Also, we understand that. And someone else pointed out that George wears bright colors, and they don't. And it's like, wow, I never thought about that.
That's what the lady said.
Yeah, that's right. She wears black all the time. She doesn't feel comfortable wearing bright colors, so she picks something out that you don't get up in the morning thinking, I'm wearing bright today, right? Yeah. She picked out something about him that she saw. And so, I mean, yeah, the whole thing is done with others. Help you see things by yourself. Good, thanks.
The whole consistency piece, and yet when I see this food thing, is we are different people in different settings.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes drastically so, sometimes subtly so.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to be different when I go home and around parents than if I'm out where nobody knows me.
Right.
Or if I'm with a group of friends.
Right.
But I'm still the same person, but there's some really consistencies there.
Yeah, I guess I think the word, maybe it's just erase the word. I think it's misleading. Because that probably means like you're the same person every setting. It's that it really sort of picks out these features of who you are. So if you said, this is what I'm like, and someone says, well, you're not like that when you're...
With me.
Yeah, with me. Or when you're at work, or when you're around your parents, you're a different person. And then, right, I guess all I mean by consistency is that it's the kind of thing that actually connects to your life. I mean, because the concern really are the radical fictions, right, the delusional people. They tell stories about themselves. The people who are rationalizing more than they are self-understanding, they're self-excusing and saying, I'm not like that, I'm never like that, you just think I'm like that, that's you, that's not me, this sort of thing, right? That's what I want to worry about. So by consistency, I meant that it tends to connect up to who you are in all your multicolored graces. I had to work that in sometimes.
I know for there are some basic themes that go through all those different environments too.
Yeah, there should, right? You should understand that there are certain guiding themes that explain why you're like this in these different settings. And you're like that for good reason. Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the consistency when you were describing before. I was thinking a friend of mine just separated from her husband, and I remember when she was a college roommate, and the whole college group came to the wedding, and we hadn't met her husband very much before then. But in the actual ceremony, the priest or whoever was officiant said, well, this is a very serious couple. I can tell that they're very, very serious values and stuff. And we all stopped and looked at each other and went, Dorothy? Ooh. Like, Dorothy's the most fun-loving, gregarious, positive person. And at that moment, we all kind of went, uh-oh, oh no.
Yeah, this is a bad sign.
This is a bad sign, and it truly was, but it was inconsistent, because Dorothy could have married a very unusual person, and that would have been okay, but she changed. That was inconsistent to say she's a serious person.
Right.
And that was right away. Later, she's like, did you guys know? We're like, yeah, we did. Yeah. Sorry. You know.
It's
actually in the ceremony, so we thought it'd be a bit.
We knew it before the vows.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So when they say any objections.
That's why I always ask the couple to write their own vows.
Oh, good. You do. Yeah. That's a great activity.
Not anymore.
That's tough. That's a lot of pressure.
But that's consistency. I mean, again, it wasn't just that it was weird or that it was a tangent. It was just wrong. It just didn't fit right.
Yeah. You know, there's one of the things I think we're going to talk about tomorrow is the way things don't fit right.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, what is that sense? And I'm going to say it's the same sort of sense you get when you look at a work of art and it doesn't seem quite right. I mean, no offense. I mean, whoever painted this, no offense. I was going to say, wow, mountains. What's with the jar? You know, maybe I just need to spend more time with it. But no offense to someone in here, maybe it's yours. You can help me out and understand it.
There's a star behind it.
Exactly. I'm sure there is, right? Yeah. I it didn't deserve. They didn't find themselves saying, you know the story?
No.
Oh,
I'd like
okay.
to know it.
Yeah.
I have the same thing.
It's not a fluke, right? It's not that they finished painting and say, wait a minute, I painted a jar. Do you know the story? Is there a story?
Part of it.
No?
Forget the story.
Okay, but there's a story.
I know of the story, just that it had to do with the matins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It had to do with the matins, something about putting rocks in jars, and so then she created a jar of the view.
Okay. That makes more sense. So now I can understand a little better what the So now it fits a
little
more.
It's actually about how how you put the rocks in the jar so that they all fit, which I think, you know.
Okay.
And you should definitely ask Steph Carpenter about it later, because I think it fits very well in some of the points you're trying to make.
Good. So if I really understood the Holden vibe, but, you know, the mood of Holden, I might really say, I'd say, how can you have a landscape without a jar? Right, something like that, the mod that you throw into the jar. Fair enough, but I was thinking that this feeling of things don't quite fit right. That's the same sort of feeling. It's not, in this case, it's not pure logic, right? When you say this, there's something about, in the same way, you know, it is a story. There's something, there's an art to it, and there's something that just doesn't seem quite right about it. And it's not, all right, go ahead, you came down into this.
I mean, it's interesting that with Heidegger, we're focusing on this kind of sense of unease and dissonance because...
I focused on that little section.
Well, because in Lyotard's critique of Heidegger, which is largely trying to figure out, you know, why did Heidegger embrace Nazism?
Yeah.
What was it about his philosophy?
There were some tough months in there.
I mean, he also talks about unease, but it's different. Because his focus on narrative requires you to kind of ignore... forget anything that is contrary to that narrative, but then those things pop up occasionally, something in your personality that's not part of your narrative, and so then you have a different kind of dissonance, which is...
Sure. So one way you can tell this is a kind of psychoanalytic story. Yeah. One way that narratives don't work is they somehow just keep breaking down. You know, things keep popping up, right? They don't enable you to function as fluidly as they should be, and you realize now that this is actually a kind of coping mechanism that's not facilitating life, but is rather interfering with the function of life. But the same sort of idea, right? Things keep popping up that don't fit. So here's what's behind this. Let me tell this, because I think I know what's behind this. But I don't think we need the Heidegger stuff. So here's the story. He was this very famous philosopher who talked about, was really concerned with the loss of values of society, and much of the sort of Nazi rhetoric about the earth and the people and the land, he thought maybe this would sort of unite us in a new set of values that he worried about modern industrial values. And so he sort of signed up as the president of the university with the party and sort of thought, well, maybe I'll be the intellectual spokesman for them and I'll give them some a little more intellectual heft than all this sort of nonsense that they're spouting. And this was in 33, so it was late enough that he should have known better. But that's not the real problem. That didn't last very long. The real problem is he never apologized for it.
Well, the recent...
His sort of personal narrative never took that up and said... explain why that mistake was there, why it was a mistake, what, and then you start to wonder why haven't you lived till 1976? Why at some point didn't you sort of, I mean, it's not that I don't think anyone believes he was a Nazi to the end, but there is this question of what is it about you that, and this would be a consistency question, what is it about you that you can talk about your life so fluidly without ever mentioning this one period? Yeah. And people around you don't even, friends of you, yeah, go ahead. And then
I was thinking, I mean, there's a pretty common notion, I think, these days where you hear people say, like, I have no regrets, you know, like, because if such and such wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't have become such and such. And
sure.
I don't necessarily buy it, but maybe, I mean, that is what you're saying. I mean, maybe he could consistently say something like, well, like, I'm not going to apologize for it because it, I don't know, like, you can't, but that's what I was at that moment.
Right, it might say something like that. And there are certainly victim narratives. I was a victim of, I got swept up in the times. Right, it's a way of sort of avoiding responsibility, but a lot of people originally are.
But this is the wrong stuff you're talking about.
Yeah.
Was that the mood?
The spirit of the times? Is that what you're wondering about?
Yeah, the mood, yeah. I mean, mood and...
Yeah, I think, it was conflicted. I mean, it wasn't the dominant spirit of the time at the time. Are you talking about what it was like in Germany in 1933 when Heidegger signed on?
Yeah.
It was early enough in the rise of Nazism that he saw himself as more giving shape to the future rather than joining the bandwagon. And he saw himself as driving the bandwagon. I remember one of the better friends. I'm sorry, I knew you were going to get into this, but I was going to be really good. But yeah, so go ahead.
It's not just the critique of Heidegger. I mean, this is right. Like this is the beginning of postmodernism, basically. And the critique of the Enlightenment Project, largely which is built around building these kind of unifying narratives that are leading us towards progress, which ended up leading us towards the Holocaust.
Right. I don't think that this has to be connected to the stories of the meta-narratives and progress and so forth. I think what you can say is, and what you should say is that you constantly are, and this is sort of the Kierkegaardian idea, you never stop telling the story. Once you start sort of telling the story, you keep telling the story over and over again. You keep re-narrating. And it's not just you open the drawer and say, yeah, that's it. Yeah, just double check it again. You can continually ask yourself, is this who I am? Is this where I'm going? Is this where I've been? And so there is no once and for all grand narrative that unifies your life, partially because you're a very diverse person. So I don't
know. But also, don't you get the understanding of looking back sometimes?
Sure. Yeah, right.
Look back and say, well, I didn't realize at the time when I made that decision it would take me down this road and then that road.
Right, of course, yeah.
And you continue living. I mean.
Yeah. You do keep going. Right. You can't stop the boat and sort of thing.
And you write it, but then you leave with more years and there's more to write and more to look back on.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
The question is the beginning of postmodernism? Seems really early, but I'm not a philosopher. When how do you qualify
postmodernism? I'm not a philosopher either. I'm just. So there's a. But you mentioned Lyotard. Lyotard has a definition of postmodernism. He calls incredulity to meta narratives. So the idea is that we should be suspicious about big stories that somehow tie everything together very neatly.
Okay, so 34 is way too early for incredulity to.
Exactly.
Meta-narratives.
Yes, I know, exactly. I know, nice job. But that's the concern, is that this whole story, really, about self-interpretation is about bringing your life together in a grand narrative. And what these postmodernists will say, that could never be anything but a kind of lie you tell yourself. Right? That's sort of the line. Is that fair?
I mean, you can look at the self-help movement.
Yeah.
Leading towards this kind of creation of the Superman, which, you know, ties in the whole mass. I mean, that'd be just like one narrative.
So, is that okay? Does that make a little more sense?
It has to be
a fiction.
I would like you to say that phrase again slowly.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, I know that.
It's just that it's a new word.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Just that putting these thoughts together is kind of.
And it was a quote from a French philosopher. So it's an incredulity to meta-narratives. So it's just a suspicion that big sweeping stories, so the big meta-narrative is the narrative of science and progress will lead us to a situation of equality, freedom, and justice for all.
Sure, but we didn't stop believing or hoping that that would be the case until until around the Vietnam War.
Some of us still hope that's the case. Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
I mean, isn't when you say postmodernism, how would you, I guess my question is.
Where would I say that started?
Yeah.
I would say that it has different meanings in different areas. There's literary postmodernism, there's philosophical, but not until the 70s.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
That's what I
would,
okay.
But yeah, so Heidegger is not a postmodern.
No.
Right, but that's your point, right?
Right.
Your point is that's why it's a problem, that we need to be postmodern. We need to be suspicious about narratives, because every narrative is a cleaning up. This would be the line, right? Every story is a whitewashing at the same time that it's a sort of a telling a tale about yourself. And the whitewashing is always never sort of, it's quite complete. You know, maybe it's not healthy, maybe it comes up in different ways. This is your concern, right? Is that fair? I don't want to put words in your mouth. I just trying to. If that were your concern, it would be a really good one. Right? I don't know if it's yours, but I would say, yeah, you've got to always be aware of the way in which the narratives you tell about yourself are just whitewashing, right? Are just as excuses for yourself or rationalizations of who you are or idealizations or unrealistic. And they're.
It's also may help these people would want you to be.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I'll give you this narrative. Yeah. This is what I want you to be.
Right, yeah. Where they, I mean, you talk about sort of being connected to others in these stories.
Right.
There's also a way in which you sort of let someone else take over the story. Right? You define yourself in that relationship with others.
Well, it's shown that if you tell a lie enough times, people begin to believe it. I mean, it seemed like that would be true for telling your own story, too.
I suppose, yeah.
If you tell a lie about it long enough that you begin to believe it really happened exactly.
Yeah. And there's enough control over who you associate with that, you know, as far as we know, your family told stories about everyone for generations back, right? But all we know is what you told us. And so we don't know any better. But yeah, so, right, go ahead, yeah.
Is any, probably what we're all creating are aspirational.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great way to put it.
If we were all very black and white and factual about ourselves,
yeah.
First of all, it would be pretty dull.
Right.
An aspirational narrative is where we're trying to some extent, rationalize what we've done. We're trying to fit it into something. We're trying mm-hmm. to, Abraham Lincoln talked about, you know, there are better angels of ourselves.
In sure.
other words, to aspire to mm-hmm. higher, better way of life.
Right, yeah. So, and that they always, what I want to say is they always have to be that way. I want to say that there's never just black and white factual stories. Because you're always picking out some facts. You're always deciding these are the relevant facts. Mm-hmm. I would say there's one way, no way to avoid telling these stories, which doesn't mean that you do it fully, responsibly. You write it down. You really articulate it. You really make these choices, and you try to live these choices. But there's no way to avoid thinking about yourself as a kind of interpretation, even if the risk is always there that what you're doing is whitewashing and making excuses for yourself. I guess that would be my line about this. Is that fair? Is that capture what you're saying? The way it's aspirational? Mm-hmm. Because it always is also, because the story, to the extent it says where I'm going, always also says, here's what it would be to live successfully, right? To flourish in who I am. I now have this picture of where I'm going, what I want to make out of my life, what I want to be, you know, what's forward for me from here. And so at that time, you also know what it would mean to succeed. As long as I get one of the Kierkegaard parables was unlike a student who could take a test and finish it in half the time, and that's a success. You can't succeed living before you're actually done with it. Mm-hmm. And that's actually kind of tragic. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are people who do that. They finish their life before they're actually done with it. Mm-hmm. That could be all sorts of, or you could have a bucket list and you finish it by 40. And you're like, well, I better get a new bucket, because you know, you've got more time. But right, this way it has to be aspirational, and it has to be something that keeps this picture of yourself alive and gives you direction for as long as you need. But you don't know what it's going to be until you live it, right? And you don't know what hurdles are going to be thrown in your path that are going to force you to revise it, you know?
Or the tree across the road.
What's that?
Or the tree across the road, the fork you thought you wanted to take.
Yeah, right, the fork you thought, or you know. My dad, who's not that old, just fell and hit his head and had a brain injury, and there's now a much smaller path about what, you know, the remaining years look like. And it didn't look like that 3 weeks ago, right? And that's, mm-hmm. and now we need a new story, you know? Before we talked, hey, you could come here. Now I'm thinking, I don't know. The hills might be too much. But, you know, so, right, and this is, you have to find new narratives because things happen to you. Yeah. Okay,
good. When Heidegger talks about Stimmung, is he talking about like a mood that could change, you know, many times throughout a day? Or is he thinking more like you're sort of wired or the times are, you know what I mean? Is it,
right.
is it macro or micro kind of that?
Okay, way? Well, he actually does both. But what's significant about it is it's something you find yourself in.
Okay.
I'm in this mood, right? It's something that sort of takes over you. It's something that really tells you about your place in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized, I'm sorry, there's a jar. This is it, right? The jar. There's a jar right here with rocks on it. I've been standing here for 5 days now. They're like, this is all coming together now. It all fits. The jar. What's important about it is that it's a kind of it's something that takes over you. It's this feeling you have.
Mm-hmm.
It's inarticulate.
Mm-hmm.
And has this sense of where you are in the world. Okay. This feeling about where you are in the world. He's, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
How are we doing over there? I forgot to look. Oh, good. Is there a last final thought today for someone who hasn't said anything yet?
Can you further explain one?
One.
I don't know.
This one.
No.
That one.
No.
No, no,
one.
Oh, the one. Oh, my God. So yeah, that's just seen up there. The one. Wait a minute. Let me hear what you were saying. What's that? So Kierkegaard talks about, he calls it leveling. How do you use leveling too? Yeah. Just that the idea that this Kierkegaard in Denmark in the 19th century, he thought all choices were becoming easier and easier. You just choose a path.
Like the herd, like you were talking about.
Exactly, the herd. Just
the herd.
Sort of, right, exactly.
The general public.
Yes, the public. So Heidegger calls it one, because you have this way of talking where you say, well, this is just what one does. You know, why are we going to dinner? This is what one does. You know, why are you doing this is what one does. It's a way of sort of excusing what you're doing, because you're not sort of saying, well, because this is what I do or we do, it's just what one does. So that's why he calls it the one. He calls it. So if I didn't want to put the one, because that makes it sound, this sort of makes it sound like we're talking religious. It's just what one does. One, whatever, you know, you can think of all sorts of things that one does. And that's what you do, because it's what one does. And often it's exactly the things you don't even think about doing otherwise, because this is what one does.
It's what's socially acceptable.
Yes.
Usually, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Which changes, of course, in different contexts and different settings. And I have an Italian wife from Chicago, and I'm a Swede from Minnesota, and we have very different social acceptable rules in our families. All right, well, that's plenty for tonight, and I think I have a baptism. Did we find out? Is that on? Is it on? Okay, yeah, so, all right, so, yeah, after Vespers, we're baptizing my 6-month-old. So. You're all welcome to join me. But tomorrow afternoon, we're going to start to talk about what makes a good interpretation and what makes a good interpreter. So how can you, what sort of things can you do to put yourself in a position to be in a good position to interpret yourself? And it may be surround yourself by people who will be honest with you or something like that. But that's what I want to talk about tomorrow. All right, thanks for coming.